Join storyteller, author, and peace builder Gareth Higgins for 8 days of soulful exploration, community, and conflict transformation in his native Ireland. Accompanied by guest musicians, authors, spiritual leaders, and community builders, explore how the stories we tell shape the possibilities we imagine. Experience the extraordinary landscape, learn from people making peace with each other after a centuries-old conflict, and go on an inner journey that might last a lifetime. More information awaits at www.irelandretreats.com.
Hello and welcome to Jesuitical, a podcast from American Media for saints and sinners. You can join us each week for honest conversations about the Catholic Church and our world today, often over drinks. I'm Ashley McKinless, and I am not joined by Zach Davis, but by our producer, Sebastian Gomes.
Hi, Ashley. Great to be with you.
Great to have you.
Zach taking an extra day.
Yeah, I left him in Ohio where he belongs.
Yeah, it's great to be with you. So how was the trip? You were in Cincinnati. You got to see one of our good friends, Father Eric Sundrup, SJ. Tell me about it.
Yeah, it was fantastic. We had an event on Tuesday night at Xavier University in Cincinnati, where Father Eric Sundrup heads up there. He's the vice president for mission and does a lot of stuff with campus ministry. So he bribed all of his campus ministry kids with pizza to come out to an event with Zach and I, where we had a great conversation with Father Sundrup about discernment, vocation, figuring out what to do with your life after college. So it was a lot of fun. And we were hosted by really good friends of the show. So Tim and Becky Riley, they came on our pilgrimage to Italy a couple years ago and hosted us at their lovely home and also took us on the Bourbon Trail.
Wow. Yeah. Busy week. Can I just say, like, we always talk about like how to bring young people into events or like why young people are, you know, not going to church or whatever. Food is like the obvious thing, right?
So
if you just put out a good spread, I feel like people will come.
Yeah. The day after, so the event was Tuesday night, and on Wednesday morning, I was with the Jesuits giving out Java and donuts, and that also brought the kids out, even at 8:30 a.m. in the morning. So.
Oh, that's awesome. And speaking of the Bourbon Trail, I mean, I'm excited to hear more about that, but that connects to our guest this week that you and Zach are talking to.
That's right. We are talking to a bourbon aficionado, Professor Amir Hussein. Amir is a theology professor at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles, where Zach and I went, and you, Sebastian, went last month as part of our Jesuitical road trip. And he is a super fascinating guy. He's Muslim. He was born in Pakistan, grew up in Toronto, and made his way over to California as a theology professor, and eventually ended up as, I think, the first Muslim professor in the theology department at LMU. So we talk about his what's that like? What were some of the challenges and pushback he faced along that journey? But he's a fascinating guy. In addition to theology, he knows everything there's to know about college basketball, about bourbon, about country music. So a real Renaissance man.
Yeah, absolutely. And his drink his recommendation is just fantastic. We're actually not going to make it because it's about 10:30 in the morning here.
And I'm fresh off the Bourbon Trail and could probably use a break.
And you're still recovering.
When I was in Kentucky, I did have a Boulevardier, which is a delicious bourbon drink. It's one-third Ryer bourbon, some Campari, and some sweet vermouth, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, so we'll put the recipe for this cocktail in the show notes for listeners. Definitely worth a make. And thanks for the recommendation, Professor Amir.
Yeah, so stick around for that conversation with Amir. We're not going to have faith sharing this week, not because Sebastian doesn't have faith, but because it's a long conversation and we want to give it some space. But before we get to that, we have Signs of the Times, the part of our show where we sift through the Catholic news of the week so you don't have to. And this week, we are bringing on friend of the show and friend of ours, Colleen Dulley, to talk about the new Vatican Declaration on Human Dignity. Welcome back to Jesuitical, Colleen.
Always great to be here.
Are you tired already of talking about this document, Colleen?
Yes. Actually, you were talking about the bourbon, and I was like, you know, it's 9:30 in the morning here, but I could go for some.
So the document is called Dignitas Infinita. And Colleen, why did this come out now? You know, a lot of people have said it feels like this is just restating a lot of established church teaching on things like the death penalty and abortion and war. So why did Pope Francis want to come out with this?
I mean, that's a great question, and I don't know that I have a good answer to it. We know that this document was in the works for like 5 years. And in recent years, the topic of gender, especially the idea of, you know, gender theory, gender transitioning, et cetera, like these have all come up to the forefront more in our public discussion. And it's clearly something that's been on Pope Francis's mind. We know from people who have talked to him that, you know, it's something he's thinking about, something he's been trying to state church teaching on in a clear way.
So in the beginning, it was going to be more focused specifically on gender ideology.
That's my understanding. Yeah. And then as kind of those 5 years progressed in which the Vatican was studying gender, you know, Pope Francis, I guess last fall, got a draft of this document. And he said, you know what? No, this needs to include a lot more. We don't know exactly what topics it had originally had or that he added, but we do know that it changed quite a lot from last November through this February when he finally read it and approved it.
And we can just list them here. Like they include the drama of poverty. So that's like the first of these issues that the Pope wants to name: war, human trafficking, migrants, and the sufferings that they experience, sexual abuse, violence against women. There's a pretty robust section on abortion. And then, you know, you mentioned gender theory, Colleen, but also just marginalization of people with disabilities, euthanasia and assisted suicide, surrogacy. So there's so much here to unpack. But it's fascinating that there's this expansive kind of trajectory in terms of the evolution of this document, right? It's almost like Pope Francis said, you can't really understand what the church wants to teach about gender theory or feels like it has to teach about gender theory outside of the context of all these other things.
Yeah, I think that's definitely the message they're trying to send. It's also interesting and has been very much overlooked that like the part on violations of human dignity, which is how all of these topics you just named are framed, is only half of the document. The first whole half of the document, like, I don't know, 7 pages, is this laying out of the Catholic thought around human rights and human dignity. And it's super interesting. I mean, it almost feels like that could have been its own document separate from the rest.
Yeah. And what is it drawing out from that history there? I mean, because it is interesting in its kind of transparency about how the church has evolved. Usually, like, well, it's transparent in how this document came about and then transparent about the subject of the document. So what were some of the key takeaways from the first half?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, it goes out of its way to say, you know, human dignity has been a concept like for most of human history. I think they specifically call out like the Greek and Roman societies and how those had a concept of human dignity. It explains that the church's understanding of human dignity is a dignity that you were born with, that cannot be taken away by anyone, that is not taken away even if you like lose your mental capacity, lose your physical capacity, right? So this is
it's inherent.
It's inherent and inviolable.
And inviolable, yep.
And they talk about then the 1948 Declaration on Human Rights, which was the UN's big document after World War II, after the atrocities against humanity that were experienced there. And the Vatican, like, full-throatedly supported and still supports this document. However, we've seen in recent years, Pope Francis especially, he's concerned that, you know, they're focusing on what he calls new rights. New rights like the right to an abortion, for example, that the UN seems to be recognizing that is part of their policies now, but that the Vatican doesn't recognize and, in fact, recognizes as a violation of human dignity. They also are careful to draw this distinction between human rights and dignity. It seems that as the UN moves more towards this language of rights, the Vatican's trying to kind of distance themselves from that, I would say. They go out of their way in this document to say that rights come from dignity, but you can't have a violation of dignity that then, you know, gets transformed into a right. That's not okay.
Yeah, and it also connects that to its discussion of freedom, right?
Yeah.
Like, because freedom is a part of our dignity. You know, freedom comes with that, but freedom should be something that is tempered by or developed by faith so that we act in our freedom, we act in ways that elevate our dignity instead of degrading it.
Right. Yeah. It's not a freedom to do whatever you want necessarily. It's a living to the fullest.
Yeah. So you've been paying much closer attention to the reception of this than I was on the Bourbon Trail. So I'm curious.
I think I wish we could have swapped places.
But what have you been hearing? Is it being well received by the church in the United States? Has there been pushback on any parts?
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing about this document. Because it covers so many topics, there is something to challenge everyone. Someone wrote a column recently in another publication that was saying, if this document is not challenging your like moral understanding of the world in some way, then you haven't read it, honestly. So yeah, I mean, from my perspective, I've been hearing a lot of reactions to the gender section, specifically the gender theory section. It creates this synthesis of what it perceives as gender theory as being something that totally removes the distinctions between men and women. But then it like links that into this section on sex change. And clearly for trans individuals, the difference between sexes is very important, right?
It sort of makes sense that like people would be drawn, like almost like a flashpoint, right? This particular topic, because as we're saying, like there's a lot in the document that is kind of established church teaching, right? Like, of course, Pope Francis, popes before him, the magisterium of the church has been very critical of the world order related to poverty and how this is like a grave injustice toward and an affront to people's human dignity. But this is, as you're saying, Colleen, like the first time that we're kind of hearing the church authoritatively speak on a couple of these issues. So that's, I mean, it's understandable that people would be drawn to it. Like every time I see a document come out of the church now, the Vatican, I'm always thinking now in like synodal terms, right? And so I'm thinking like, who are the people who are either most involved in this issue, for example, the different folks in the different sciences who are studying gender, studying, you know, sex in nature, different animal species, this type of thing. And then how are we like incorporating the voices of the people who are most affected by the violation of some of one kind or another, right? So, you know, to speak to trans people, to speak to scientists would be like an obvious thing to do in this case. But I don't know if the Vatican did that proactively.
Yeah. I don't either. And I brought up that criticism to our Vatican correspondent, Jared O'Connell, on our Inside the Vatican podcast this week. And he was like, well, do you need to consult poor people to denounce poverty? So it's kind of
an
interesting,
you do.
Different view. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of like the academic engagement that they made, I really don't know. I mean, you say that they said in the document that they've been working on this for 5 years. We know that the Vatican has these pontifical academies, social sciences, life, and so on, that you don't have to be a Catholic to be part of. You don't have to like support Catholic teaching and your scholarship to be part of. They want honest discussions. And so the Vatican certainly had the resources to engage, you know, very critically with these subjects. And I think that when you look at the 100 footnotes, more than 100 footnotes in this document, they're not actually citing any of that wealth of, you know, information, current scholarship that is available to them.
Well, I think one thing when I'm thinking about those more controversial parts of it is seeing it in the context of the entire document and the theme of the document, which is human dignity. It is not an entire document on gender ideology or surrogacy. And so it's asking, what does our human dignity, like the givenness of our humanity, the gift that each human being is, what can we extrapolate from that? And yes, in a more comprehensive document, maybe you would want to bring some more scientific voices into that. But it's also not a pastoral document. You know, it's not saying, given what we're saying about gender ideology, this is what you need to be implementing on the ground. So I actually appreciated what it said in that regard. So just throwing that out there.
Yeah, and I think we can't presume that the church is just wrong on any of these things, because it's coming from such a deep, well thought out tradition. I mean, I mentioned to Ashley before we started recording, like it strikes me as such a typical Pope Francis document in that the first half of it is this like meticulously argued kind of theoretical kind of conceptualization of like human dignity and like where the church is coming from relative to this. And then the second half, the things that like Pope Francis was really insisting on putting in the document, like we know from some of your reporting, Colleen, is like the more practical application of that, right? Like here are like the specific things that we need to look out in the world and say, here are the violations of the human dignity. So it has this like both and thing. So in many ways, it's kind of a very typical Vatican church document.
Totally. Classic Pope Francis. And I mean, I do think it's a good thing to have something that challenges everyone, no matter what angle they're coming from.
And if you want to hear more about this declaration from the Vatican on human dignity, you should definitely hop over to Inside the Vatican, where Colleen and Jerry O'Connell broke it down in a more comprehensive way. And you're going to be on another panel with America folks talking about it, right, Colleen?
Yeah, right after this, I'm jumping into a recording with our editor-in-chief, Sam Sawyer, and our former national correspondent, who's now the executive director of Outreach, which is our LGBT Catholic resource, Mike O'Loughlin. So we're going to be having a further, more in-depth discussion on Dignitas Infinita.
All right. Thanks for jumping on with us, Colleen.
No problem.
Now stick around for the conversation that Zach and I recorded when we were at Loyola Marymount University with Amir Hussein about being a Muslim professor at a Jesuit university. Joining us at Loyola Marymount University is Professor Amir Hussein. Amir is the Dom Professor in the Bellarmine College of Liberal Arts, the past president of the American Academy of Religion, and the Professor of Theological Studies at Loyola Marymount University. Welcome to Jesuitical, Amir.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
So we were telling folks on campus that we were going to be chatting with you, and the first thing we were recommended to talk to you about is the fact that you don't own a cell phone and never have.
I think that is my claim to fame, is I am the only adult human being who has never owned a cell phone.
Akiris, when did you decide to really dig your heels in and just commit to the bit?
That was, you know, after the smartphone era. So I'm old enough that I remember the days of pagers. And my other life was I worked with people with headaches with behavior problems. So when I was managing a facility, I had a pager. I hated having the pager because no one paged you to say, hey, where are you at? They paged you because so-and-so was in crisis. So when the shift came from pagers to cell phones, it was like, I don't need that. You know, my best friend's a vascular surgeon. He needs to have the phone because it's literally life or death. That's not the case with me. You know, my dean's never going to say, you know, they just don't understand the second person of the Trinity. You have to give them an emergency tutorial. You know, it's not that important.
Okay, but you live in LA and there's traffic.
Absolutely.
And how do you know the best way to get
somewhere? But this was the thing. And so when the move came from cell phones to smartphones, it was the same thing. Like, I have a desktop in the office. I have a desktop at home. I have a laptop I travel with. Why would I need another computer I could put in my pocket? And so I think this is the key here, is I've never had one, so I don't know what I'm missing. Mm-hmm. I also know addiction, and I see this kind of thing. Like, I can't tell you how many times students have almost bumped into me because, of course, they're looking down at their phones and texting instead of looking. And so you get around this. It's like, it's the old days of Thomas guys. It's the old days. I literally print off stuff from MapQuest or Google Maps to do the kind of thing. You got to do this. It's old school. But I think I'm still in touch. So I think when we were discussing, you know, being on this program, I don't think, you know, there's a long delay in me responding to you or working with you.
No, so. You're quite responsive in email. I feel like when people talk to you, I would imagine that there's almost this sense of bewilderment, but also a longing that they actually kind of want a life without their smartphone. Is that true?
Absolutely. Because, and I'm very serious when I use the word addiction, because I think with a lot of folks, it is this addiction, you know, and I know what addiction is. My undergrad degree was in psychology. I have my own addiction. I don't have this particular one there. And I think I'm actually more happy and well-adjusted precisely because I don't have social media, because I don't have a Twitter account. I mean, my thing on social media is LinkedIn. That's it. And no one uses that to do anything other than sort of, you know, look for a job.
Or post these sort of vapid, like inspirational.
Right. Well, the other part of it, and this becomes quite serious, is like, I know what this stuff is, even though I don't use it. So I know what Instagram is. I know how that works. And I remember talking to my students about this because I just assumed that they were just taking pictures of themselves to post. Then you realize, oh, no. It has to be carefully curated. And you see like these 19-year-old women, and they have to completely filter and Photoshop and spend 3 hours. I'm like, what does that do to you? Like, what's going to happen when you get to be my age and you have the wrinkles and the gray hair or the no hair or all those kinds of things? And just that moment of like, this is completely artificial, like in a really negative kind of way. And you're projecting not who you are, but, you know, the sort of projection that you want people to see of you. And then the other part, and I'll stop here, is I say to my students, look, I've got a handful of friends that I will get on a plane for. Like, those are your friends. Like, I have a hard enough time trying to keep in touch with my actual friends, not 1,000 virtual friends or, you know, getting likes. So I don't know what that's like. And I think I'm a happier person. I won't say better, but I think I'm a happier person for that.
It's almost like a spiritual practice of, I mean, the level of detachment there. Are you ever tempted to get one, or are you just like, you've seen, no thanks, I don't want
now
that.
Now I think, and this goes back to your first question, I think now it's far enough along that I can't get one.
No, yeah.
You know, except for one of two reasons. Either, you know, Verizon gives me the $1 million thing, and we finally got them, and, you know, here's the thing. Or probably more likely, Johns Hopkins gives me the $1 million because we want your brain.
We were told that you want to give your brain to science.
Well, I'm sure like the neural connection. Now, of course, my friends will say, yeah, your brain's already different to begin with. So, you know, I'm enough of a scientist to know that an N of one isn't all that useful. But at the same time, like, I bet you my neural connections are actually quite different because I've never had one and done this.
Yeah. We were talking about, like, what are we actually going to interview him about? Because we could talk to you for an hour about not having a cell phone. We're in your office. We could talk to you about basketball for probably 10 hours.
Ashley would just watch, yeah, I think. But or country music.
Yeah. But we are also in the theology department here at LMU. And you are Muslim, teaching at a Jesuit Catholic school. So we do want to dig into what that is like. So what drew you here initially?
It's a great story because I did my work at the University of Toronto squarely in the study of religion. It was a comparative program. So I did early Christianity and Islam. My dissertation
was on that. I'm a religious studies major and I was Christianity and Islam.
Wonderful. Yeah. Wonderful. And you can see the sort of connection, just see the kinds of links there. And so I did a dissertation looking at Muslim communities in Toronto, got a job teaching at Cal State Northridge. So in the San Fernando Valley, part of the Cal State University system. I love that because I was a working class kid, first kid in the family to go to university. Both my parents worked in factories. So that transformative power education was amazing. But every year we had to do more with less. Every year we have more students, fewer resources. They brought in a new chancellor. And it's funny what you remember from 20 years ago, who very publicly declared that he saw the value of the Cal State University system, and I quote, as creating educated workers for the California workforce. And I thought, huh, I thought I was trying to create educated citizens for the world, not workers for California. Don't get me wrong, I want kids to get a job. I mean, that was me. You go to university, right. You have a better job than your parents working in a factory. So I get the workplace placement. So then I was thinking, okay, is there a place that actually creates educated citizens for the world? And as it happens, you know, the next year, there was a job opening at Loyola Marymount. I'm not Catholic. I'm not Christian. Are non-Christians welcome? Are non-Catholics welcome? Wasn't sure. You know, almost 20 years later, I can't imagine a better place to be than this Catholic Jesuit institution. It's taken me years to understand sort of Jesuit education and what they do, but the formation, the kind of work there is really extraordinary. And it's this amazing privilege to be in this Catholic Jesuit place, which never would have crossed my mind when I finished my PhD. Like, if you'd asked me in 1997, do you see yourself teaching at a Jesuit school in California? Like, are you high? Like, why would I go to California? Jesuits, I don't even know what the Jesuits are. Catholic school.
Were you the
Catholic
first Muslim theology professor here?
So not only the first Muslim, I was the first non-Christian to be sort of tenured in the department, you know. And you go back in the day, like typically when you started, the Jesuits were the Jesuits who were the theology professors. Then you bring in lay Catholics. Then you bring in lay Catholic women. So Marianne Majeski, who's been retired for 20 years, you know, the first woman, you know, in the department. Then you bring in Chris Chappell, who's a Protestant. Our chair for years was Jeff Seiker, who's a Presbyterian. So I was the first non-Christian, you know, who was tenured, you know, in the department. And that's changing across Jesuit schools. You know, there's 27 Jesuit schools in the U.S. Almost all of them now have someone teaching about Islam, which I think is really important.
I'm curious if students today are able to, well, let me premise it this way. When I was at university, I feel like I had to get over this impulse to like defend my religion when I was in theology classes, or like break out of this bubble that, I don't know, I was at a Catholic school and therefore I should only hear Catholic voices. Do you encounter that among students today?
It's all over the place, because I'll have students take my class. So I do like a first year seminar on Islam. I do upper division course on Islam. I do like a religion film class. A lot of the students will say, yeah, I took your course, because I asked them the first day, you know, why are you here? Why did you pick this class and not the other 84 classes we have in theology? And a lot of them will say, look, I grew up Catholic. I had 12 years of Catholic school. I want to learn about something other than the Catholic tradition. Others will say, yeah, I don't know the first thing about Islam and Muslims. I want to learn about, you know, this. And so I think sometimes you do have folks that say, yeah, I'm pretty good with the Catholic education because I've had it for 12 years. I want to learn something.
I signed up for a Roman Catholicism class because I thought it was going to be a like sort of a gut class. Like I was just going to show up and walk through the, and it was taught by an old Jesuit that put me through the ringer. So that was a mistake I made when I signed up for classes.
I say that to my students all the time who are Muslim students, because we have about 250 Muslim students out of about 6,000 students. I say that to my Muslim students, like, don't think that because you're a Muslim, you're going to get an A in my Islam class. And I use the analogy of English. Just because you're a native speaker of English doesn't mean you're going to get an A in the English, because the English class isn't just about speaking the language. It's understanding things. Same thing. Like, you know, you're a cradle Catholic, but do you understand the history of the church? Do you understand what happened at the Council of Trent? Do you understand why Catholic doctrine is this way versus that way? You know, those are the kinds of things that are much different. And I think the other part is, I think there's a genuine curiosity here in LA, because here we are in Los Angeles, the largest Catholic archdiocese in America, you know, but the most religiously diverse city, I think, in the world. You know, best place in the world to study Buddhism is right here, because every single kind of Buddhist community is here. You know, second largest Jewish population after New York City, one of the largest Muslim populations. You know, I can take you to a Hindu temple in Calabasas. You know, how do you understand that complexity becomes really interesting, I think, for the students, whether they're Catholic or not.
Did you face any resistance when you first started being the first Muslim professor?
And I think that's one of those things that's depressing sometimes, where, you know, you have folks that think that and I'm talking about faculty, mm-hmm. who think that a Catholic university is defined by the number of Catholic faculty, and that Catholic universities should have Catholic students and Catholic faculty. Of course they should. I'm not saying they shouldn't. But a university, by definition, should bring in people who have expertise in different areas. And so for me, like, you know, when I was thinking about coming here and applying, that last line of our mission statement, you know, the service of faith and the promotion of justice. And I thought, that's fascinating. Because as a Muslim, I can get behind that. It's not the holy Catholic faith. It's not the one true faith. It's faith. That's really crucial. Do you support the mission of the university? And I think it's a mistake to think that only Catholics support that mission. You know, I look at this and go, this is amazing. I want to sign on. We can talk about this later. A couple of years ago, I did the spiritual exercises, you know, with Father Randy Roche, and that really deepened my understanding. A couple of years ago, going to Barcelona for a conference on Jesuit education, because I've got a pretty good sense of what happened in the U.S., but of course, the Jesuits, the Catholics are not just in the U.S., they're around the world.
What are the issues that come to play in
that? Well, it was really fascinating, because I think for me, there was this sense of, okay, I'd studied early Christianity. I know, you know, the New Testament pretty well, but I'd also come to admire Ignatius as a teacher. And so I talked for years and years about when to do this. And what really short answer to your question is, I became department chair in 2020. And so for me, there was a sense of, okay,
it's a fun year to do that.
Well, it was fascinating, you know, right in the middle of the pandemic and the online classes and all that kind of stuff there. But it was great, because there's no precedent. And so, you know, it's not like you're competing against someone who's also done kind of stuff there. So no pressure in that kind of way. But I knew that I would have to now start dealing with some of the issues, because as a faculty member, you can naively assume that everyone is great and everyone does their job really well. But when you're department chair, then all of a sudden the students start talking to you about, oh, so-and-so didn't show up to class, or, you know, I don't know what grade I've gotten because it's the eighth week and I haven't gotten anything back. And so you begin to start hearing negative things about, you know, colleagues, about things that happen there. And so I knew that I would need a place for me, like, spiritually, psychically, psychologically, however you want to say it, where do I put that? How do I deal with this? Because these people are my friends, you know, but now I'm not in charge of them because as a department chair, you're not a manager, but you're the one that people now come to when there's issues. What do I need to do to help myself with that? And so that was really the primary reason at that moment for doing the spiritual exercises. And Father Randy Roche, who's sort of a legend here.
But you didn't seek out something within your own religious tradition. No, and I imagine that exists.
It does. And I think because part of it for me was also getting a deeper sense of what this place is as a Catholic Jesuit institution there. When I came to LMU, I didn't know the first thing about the Jesuits. So I asked a friend who knew very much about the Jesuits. I'm going to a Jesuit school. What should I learn? How do I learn about this? He says, well, two things. Read John O'Malley as the first Jesuit. John O'Malley, you know, marvelous mm-hmm. Jesuit, just died a year or so ago. Amazing scholar. His book, The First Jesuits, great account of Ignatius and the first Jesuits. But then my friend said, and read Cervantes. And I'm like, you want me to read a novel like Don Quixote? Like, why on earth would I read Don Quixote to understand? He's like, just do it. And of course, I got where he was coming from. This is the world that Ignatius Loyola is coming from. That's that world of medieval Spain, which is a world that's deeply connected to its Jewish and its Muslim roots. Right. You know, we in America know 1492 because of Columbus. People in Spain know 1492 because of the Reconquista, you know, where you sort of try to strip Spain of its Jewish and Muslim past. So the intertwining. So back to your question. Part of it was this really interesting thing about, so where's this world that Ignatius is coming from? Where are these kinds of influences here? And I think, and I say this as someone who's a scholar of religion, I think Ignatius was one of the great sort of spiritual religious teachers, you know, in the world, looking at the exercises, doing the exercises with Father Randy. It was really interesting because it's, of course, the 19th annotation, you know.
Which is sort of like this adaptation for people who can't make a 30-day silent retreat.
Exactly, right? Because for most of us, I couldn't quite go to my wife and say, hey, honey, guess what? I'm going to go away for 30 days.
Can't even go to your boss at a Jesuit institution and say
I'm going away for 30 days to do this kind of thing. You know, and if you can do that, that's great. And so how do you do this over a number of weeks? And again, this was done during the pandemic over Zoom. And so I'd meet with Father Roche, and he was very clear that, look, I'm not directing this. God is directing this. So that was part of the appeal. I'm here to help you. I'm here to sort of, you know, guide you on this, but I don't see myself guiding this. God is guiding. You know, this. So that appealed to me as well, you know, as a Muslim. And so we'd meet every week, we'd talk for a little bit, and then he'd give me the kinds of readings. And he asked me, do you want me to do the spiritual exercise in the way that I would do it for Catholics? Because he's done it for a number of different folks. You can do it for non-Christians. And I'm like, no, give me the Catholic version of it.
Which is pretty Christocentric.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's precisely the point there, because as someone who knows the New Testament, meaning as a non-Christian, but as a scholar, who's read the text, who has, you can see on my shelf, I got an SELA on Greek New Testament. I can sort of make my way through the Greek text, you know, with that and a concordance, that kind of thing. But that's not the same thing as being a believer and understanding this. And so that precisely was it. So as a non-Christian, I can appreciate, you know, Good Friday, but it's a completely different reading of this text as a Christian, where this isn't just a figure that I know, because as a Muslim, Jesus is important to me. It's a completely different Jesus, you know, from the New Testament Jesus, from the Jesus of Christians, particularly of Catholic Christians. And so, you know, getting your head in that space, that this isn't just the death of God's prophet. This is the death of God. And what does that mean? And where does that come in? And what sort of God allows God's self to be killed by God's own creation? I mean, and the sort of issues that raises are really, really quite powerful. But I think, again, one of the great insights that Ignatius had is, okay, put yourself in that scene. What's it like to do this? You know, what's it like? Imagine yourself here watching this, watching that.
And this helped you deal with campus politics?
It did. It helped me deal, because again, you have to have your own sort of sense of who you are.
Yeah.
If you're going to be able to help and adjust and not just get, you know, ticked off at folks.
I'm wondering, I think most people would kind of want to know, like, are you, when you're engaging in the spiritual exercises, are you sort of acting, you're like, okay, for the next hour I'm praying, I'm going to act as if I were a Christian? Or are you still firmly yourself trying to appreciate it as someone who's a Muslim?
I think it's a little of both, because certainly there's a sense of, oh, look, I'm a Muslim. I'm not trying to become a Catholic or anything like that, you know. But at the same time, you know, how would a Catholic understand this? And as much as you can sort of put yourself in that position, you know, in the same way. And so in my comparative theology class, I use Jack Miles's Religion as We Know It, where he talks about, you know, when you study religion, do you have to believe in this? Well, we're not sure if the ancient Greeks actually believed in Zeus, you know, but those stories were important to them. You know, can you suspend that belief? Can you say that, you know, you may not believe this, but clearly the people writing this text believe this. Can you put yourself into that story? Whether that story is King Lear, whether that story is the Iliad, whether that story is the New Testament.
What would you recommend for a Christian trying to do a similar exercise of exploring the faith and beliefs of their Muslim neighbors? We were talking earlier about Father Brian Maskell's piece about fasting.
Yeah. And so if you look at the kind of work that people do, I think oftentimes it's not an intellectual thing. And so I think that that's where the exercises were so important because, sure, it was reading these texts. Here's the text to read. But then it's the reflection. It's the prayer. It's the journaling. You know, people will say, look, I want to learn about Islam. Let me pick up a Quran. I'm like, yeah, no, that's exactly the same. I want to learn about Christianity. Let me pick up a New Testament. Because then you start reading this text and looking at the people and going like, wait, I don't think you do. You know, what's the great line from Princess Bride? You know, you keep on using this word. I don't think it means what you think it means. Like, you know, it's like, are you actually living this out? Are you doing this? And so I think if you want to learn about Islam, make a Muslim friend, you know, go hang out with them. Have them take you to the prayer service. Eat with them. You know, there's a great saying of the Prophet Muhammad that literally the person who prays with us and eats with us is one of us, you know, which I think talks about the communal aspect of this. Father Brian Massengill in that beautiful piece in America, you know, as a Catholic priest talking about fasting during Ramadan and what it's like to do this practice. You know, Christians have that with Lent. The Orthodox basically become vegetarians. You know, for Lent. Well, Catholics used to do that. You know, what's it like to not just fast on Ash Wednesday and Good Friday?
And only kind of fast.
but exactly doing that. And so you look at the great thinkers, the great spiritual thinkers, whether it's someone like Ignatius from the Catholic side or someone like a Jalaluddin Rumi from the Muslim side, I think that's the appeal that there's a, when I say universality, I don't mean you don't forget the particular. Like Rumi was a Muslim. Ignatius was a Catholic. There's no doubt about any of that. But you're speaking to people who are human beings, not just Catholics, not just Muslims.
Yeah. So I went to a public university, so we didn't have a theology department. So I was a religious studies major. And one of my favorite classes I took, it was taught by a Jewish man. And he started this movement. It was called like scriptural reasoning. And it was kind of this like revolt against the Enlightenment approach to like studying religion, where you like leave behind your priors and your faith and you study it as a rational human being. But the class was, we looked at passages in the Quran, the Hebrew Bible, and the New Testament that had to do with housing and poverty. And then part of the class was also like volunteering for Habitat for Humanity. So it's very similar to this idea of like, yeah, do something together, which this is before Pope Francis, but that like that has been his approach to interfaith dialogue is, yeah, we can get to doctrine and theology at some point, but what can we do now?
His famous phrase is like, we'll put the theologians on an island and they can figure it out. But we're going to like eat and serve together.
We're going to plant a tree and get on with it.
So actually, was that at UVA?
It was. Yeah. Do you know Peter Oakes?
I know Peter. No, but I think about, you know, UVA, like going back to Mr. Jefferson, who founded it, you know, Thomas Jefferson in 1765 had a Quran. Mm-hmm. Like people aren't aware of that, you know. Jefferson was not interested in becoming a Muslim, but, you know, as someone who's writing a document, you know, that's kind of important to Americans, you might want to have a comparative perspective. So for him, like learning about Islam, learning about the Quran, and I think that that's crucial, you know, knowing the text, but then it's how are these texts understood? How are these texts lived out? And so that was my experience. You know, I went to school like you at a public university, University of Toronto. You know, my first interfaith encounter had nothing to do with a theology class or anything like that. I grew up working class poor. This was the beginning of what would become the food bank sort of movement. There was a Protestant church, United Church of Canada, that was sort of close to the university campus. They were doing this thing about, you know, coming together to help feed the hungry. And so that was it for me. It's like, oh, let me go to this place because here are people who are concerned about people who are hungry. And, you know, my family had been hungry when we'd first come. And so that's a personal thing for me. And that was it. So my first moment of doing this stuff was really exactly that, is doing this interfaith work to help feed the hungry. We didn't talk about theology. We just cared about the fact that all of us, you know, were concerned about our neighbors who were hungry.
You mentioned Thomas Jefferson having a Quran, and a lot of your work has been trying to educate Americans about Muslim contributions to this country.
Yeah, most of us think that American Muslims are relative newcomers, and that's not entirely false. Like, most Muslims have come here since 1965 with the changes to immigration law that came with changes in civil rights law. But we've got a history in this country that goes back to before this country. You know, the first person we can say with certainty who was a Muslim that was here was a slave of one of the Spanish conquistadors, Estevancio, little Stephen, you know, the Moor, who was a slave of one of the conquistadors who came in 1528. So you think about that for a second, that in 1528, there was a Muslim here, you know. If you go to Texas, the state capital in Austin has the, I can't remember what it's called. I think it's the Texas African American Historical Monument. There's a image of Estevanico there because he's believed to be the first person of African descent to come into Texas. Well, what does it mean that the first person of African descent to come to Texas also is a Muslim? Because of course, Islam has been in West Africa. I was a kid when Alex Haley's Roots came on, you know, with LeVar Burton playing Kunta Kinte, and this moment of, wait, Kunta Kinte was a Muslim? There were Muslim slaves? Well, of course, if you've got, you know, Islam in West Africa and we're bringing slaves from West Africa, it stands to reason that some of them would have been Muslim. And so there's this history. We're coming up on 500 years of Muslims in what is now the United States of America. And then the kinds of contributions that people have made. I mean, you think about the horrors of 9/11 and 19 Muslims that took down the World Trade Center. Extraordinary tragedy. But if you walk around Chicago and look at the skyline, you know, the reason that skyline is there is a Muslim guy, Fazlur Rahman Khan, you know, who came to school at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, joined this firm, Skidmore, Owings, Merrill, became a structural engineer who helped build these tall buildings. So the reason you have the John Hancock Building and the Sears Tower, the reason you were able to build a building like the World Trade Center was because of this Bangladeshi Muslim guy. But we don't pay attention to that. My other great hero, so I dedicated this, the last book I did, to my two great heroes, who were Muhammad Ali, who just died the year the book had come out, and Ahmet Erdogan, who was a Turkish founder of Atlantic Records. And I would submit to you that, you know, if you want to understand the history of America in the 20th century, not American music, but America, you got to understand Atlantic Records, the R&B records. They signed Ray Charles, did this thing. Well, it's a Turkish Muslim guy who, with his Jewish friend, with like a loan from their dentist, create Atlantic Records, you know, signs the Rolling Stones to distribute their stuff through Atlantic Records. You know, in the book, I have a picture of him with, it's funny to think about this, with Kid Rock. You know, because he signs Kid Rock to Atlantic Records. And here's Kid Rock.
Notable interreligious
Notable
advocate.
Interreligious figure, you know. But there he is, you know, with his arm around this Turkish Muslim guy, you know, who's the chairman of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. You know, so when you think about rock and roll, do you think about this? Now, for my students, they understand the contemporary part because they don't know Ahmet Erdogan. But they know Wu-Tang Clan. They know Tribe Called Quest. They know Mos Def and Talib Kweli. They know that Alicia Keys' husband, Swiss Beatz, is a Muslim. And so you have this really interesting kind of, you know, where's the Muslim undercurrent in the music? Well, my students know that because of rap and hip hop.
So I did not know any of that. You mentioned 9/11. And so I was in sixth grade growing up in Arlington, Virginia when 9/11 happened. If there were Muslims in my class, I didn't know that they were Muslim. So like, for I think a lot of people my generation who didn't grow up in a very religiously diverse area, that was like our introduction to Islam. And that's, it's part of the reason when I went to UVA, I wanted to study Islam and just try to understand what this religion was. So I don't know. What would you say to someone who that was their introduction to be like?
No, absolutely. And that was a wake-up call. So I'm old. So I was here, you know, teaching, you know, when that happened. And so I taught for 4 years at Cal State Northridge before 9/11. I would start my class on Islam with a book actually by an ex-Jesuit, Frank Peters. Now, Frank taught at NYU for years, a book called Muhammad and the Origins of Islam. If you want to know about Muhammad, the origins of Islam from a critical, historical, not particular religious perspective, that book is magnificent. And I use that book because my students, whether they were Muslim or not, didn't know much about Islam. Post 9/11, my students came in knowing everything about Islam, except that everything they knew was wrong, because where they got it from was the television, was a sensational kind of stuff. It wasn't from, you know, Muslims or academics who knew about Islam. It's still the case now where if you look at the Pew Forum on religion and public life, does great research on religion. 60% of Americans, when asked, will say they don't know a Muslim, you know, and you want to say, you probably do know a Muslim, but you probably don't know that they're Muslim. In the same way you can say, I don't know anyone that's gay. Yeah, you do know someone that's gay. You just don't know that they're gay. Like, you know, in that kind of way. Yeah. Like your cardiologist may be a Muslim. Your kid's teacher may be a Muslim, but you don't talk to them about them being a Muslim because they're your kid's teacher. They're your cardiologist.
That's so funny. My doctor was Dr. Bearcat. He was probably Muslim.
Right. No, exactly. You didn't talk to him about Islam or Muslims or things like that. And so how do you learn? And I think the good thing was for a lot of people is like, wait a minute, what's going on? And then the other part for those of us as American Muslims who are here and completely bereft by what had happened, you know, completely sympathizing with Americans, because of course that's who we are, that's who we were, you know. So 9/11 happens on a Tuesday, you know. On the Thursday, I'm sitting in my office at Cal State Northridge. I get a phone call from a United Methodist minister saying, oh, Pastor Hussein, would you like come speak at our church on Sunday? And I'm like, Pastor, forgive me. I'm a little busy. So, I mean, I'm sorry. I didn't explain myself. And he gave me his name, Japanese American with a Japanese American United Methodist congregation. And what he said, it still brings tears to my eyes, you know, over 20 years later. He says, look, after Pearl Harbor, very few non-Japanese stood with us. You know, we want to stand with you, but we need to know who you are. We need to know more about you. So will you come and help us understand more about you? To this day, I have no doubt that American Muslims weren't interned post 9/11, precisely because Japanese Americans were interned post Pearl Harbor. Mm. And what we found out in the decades later, no, these were good Americans. These weren't secret agents of the Japanese emperor trying to do harm to America. What we did with the internment was terrible, you know. But I think, you know, sometimes we talk about we don't learn from history. That's an example where we did learn from history, and you do those kinds of things. You make those kinds of connections, you know, learning about Islam, learning about Muslims. And the more you learn about this, the more you realize, oh, these people aren't, you know, scary people who want to bring down America. These people came to America because of America. I look at myself. I grew up in Canada. I'm a Canadian citizen. I became a U.S. citizen a little over a decade ago, you know, and that's from Canada. That's not coming from Yemen or Somalia where there's hunger and famine or war. That's coming from Canada, this nice, really, you know, decent sort of place. But it goes back to Mr. Jefferson. It goes back to the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, this idea that there's something special about this place and wanting that American dream. You know, people come to America precisely because they want and love America, not because they hate America and want to destroy it. You know, you get that image. You want to learn. You want to understand this. And so I think it's always horrible to think of good things coming out of tragedy. But if you think of good things coming out of tragedy, it was people learning more about Islam and Muslims.
You mentioned off mic when we were chatting that one of the great tragedies is that Catholics in particular have contributed to Islamophobia in a way that's sort of almost, I don't know what the word is, but
not ironic, but
because we should know, right?
No, absolutely. And so you look at someone like Philip Jenkins, who has a number of great books, including one about, you know, the last acceptable religious prejudice of being anti-Catholicism. But people who are older will remember this, the Big John, Little John sort of caricature, which was during the Kennedy election, you had a sort of a silhouette of Jack Kennedy on his knees, John the 23rd in his papal throne with the handout, with the ring, and Kennedy kissing the ring. And there was no text other than literally Big John, Little John. But the message was clear to American Protestants in the 1960s. You elect this Catholic guy. He's the one that's really going to run the country, not John Kennedy, John the 23rd. He's going to be a secret agent of the Pope, and this is the Vatican sort of running the American government. And so that prejudice against Catholics, like you look at New York City, you look at St. Patrick's Cathedral, you know, can you imagine New York without St. Patrick's Cathedral? Well, when that was built in New Amsterdam, you know, you had to set up guards to keep the Protestant mobs from tearing it down. They actually tore down part of it, you know. Fast forward, we don't want a mosque in our neighborhood. Why would we want this? You know, why would we have this kind of thing? And so I think, you know, if there's one group that knows the experience of American Muslims post 9/11, it's American Catholics, because this was your history as foreigners who don't speak the language, who won't assimilate, who have this strange religion, not just the good Protestant, you know, American thing, you know. And I think, unfortunately, sometimes you have that sort of prejudice, because once you become part of the mainstream, once you become part of the structure, you forget that there's others who are kind of like you. That's where we mentioned, actually, I think it was you, Pope Francis. What that man has done has been extraordinary. You know, the Syrian refugee crisis happens. What does Pope Francis do? Gets three Muslim families and takes them in. You know, extraordinary. It's not about writing a text, not doing stuff. It's like, oh, you're scared of Muslims? You're scared of Syrian refugees? Guess what?
I got three families living with me. Is it trickling down? Do you get a sense that it is affecting Catholics here in the U.S.?
I think it depends on who those folks are, because again, what do you listen to? Who influences you? Are you caught up in that world? Without getting into the political, you know, do you vote for a particular candidate because they represent a particular issue that you've been told is the most important issue, and the rest of Catholic social teaching doesn't seem to fit in, you know, there. So I think it depends. And in a funny way, it's the same thing with Muslims. Like, you know, you look at Catholics and the huge diversity of Catholics, you know, Latino Catholics, Irish Catholics, you know, Catholic worker Catholics, Opus Dei, Catholics, completely different, you know, left, right, with the same thing with Muslims. And so sometimes you see more connections, you know, with folks, not because of religious stuff, but because it's the same ethnicity, it's the same socioeconomic status, those kinds of things.
I mean, I think we could probably talk for 10 hours. Next time we'll do a basketball podcast. But before we let you go, I wanted to ask you one final question that we ask all our guests, which is if you could canonize one person, living or dead, Catholic or not, Muslim or not, fictional or real, who would it be and why?
Tough question. And so, you know, top of your head, and I'm saying this because I'm looking at the wall behind you, you know, when I moved to Los Angeles, I got to meet Coach John Wooden, an extraordinary human being. So I would pick John Wooden only because I know how much it would really annoy him, because he didn't see himself, like, he hated being called the Wizard of Westwood. He hated being called like a saint. Like, for him, he was just an ordinary person.
For us, not basketball fans, who was he?
Yeah, so Coach John Wooden, I would say greatest coach ever, you know, coached the UCLA men's basketball team to 10 national championships. No one else has come close to that, you know, retired as probably the greatest coach, you know, of all time. But I think he saw his athletes as people with potential and promise. And I think it goes back to that notion that, you know, no one should be made head of something who wants to be that job. They should be brought in kicking and screaming. No one that wants to be canonized should be canonized. It should be people who say, no, I'm not worthy. This is not me. I don't want this kind of thing. And so someone like him, for just the sort of way in which he lived in the world, you know, the kind of work that he did, the good stuff that he did, the connections there. And it wasn't about basketball. Like this guy was the winningest ever when it comes to NCAA men's basketball. No one's come close to 10 national championships. Coach Wooden didn't care about winning or losing. It was about, are you doing the best you can do to become the best person that you can? That's the the key. And so, you know, I think just because I know how much it would annoy him, I'd pick like John Wooden.
John Wooden. Yeah. Well, how would he affair it with in the transfer portal NIL era?
And that was the other thing, because people forget, like, John Wooden was one of those rare guys who's in the Hall of Fame both as a player and as a coach. So when he played for Ward Lambert at Purdue, he was this astonishing, you know, player. I think he'd do just fine. So as a player, as a coach, but more importantly, as a human being, you know, a guy like John Wooden, just extraordinary.
Awesome. Amir, anything you want to plug for our listeners?
Unfortunately, no, because I'm not doing anything at this point. But the last book,
if that's you're not true. I see, like, your office is here. You're doing things.
So I'm doing lots of things. Yeah. No, so the last book, which is the book about Islam and Muslims, is a book from Baylor University Press called "Muslims: The Making of America," which really looks at that history of Islam and Muslims in this country.
Awesome.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thank you.
Jesuitical is produced by Sebastian Gomes, with production assistance from Michael O'Brien, Delaney Coyne, and Kevin Christopher Robles, who's also our sound engineer. Faith formation provided by Father Eric Sundrup. You can follow us on X and Instagram at Jesuitical Show. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/groups/Jesuitical. Please subscribe wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and if you're on Apple or Spotify, leave us a review. Jesuitical is recorded in the William J. Loschert Studio at American Media in New York City. For American Media, I'm Ashley McKinless with Sebastian Gomes. We'll see you next week.